Well, hi there, Jonathan Doyle with you again for the weekly podcast. Thanks, as always, for the privilege of your time. Hope you had a good weekend. If you're downloading this early in the week, if you're downloading it later, then hang in there. The weekend is almost here. But I'm looking forward to doing this one. I always am on the lookout for great content, for stuff to share with you. And as you know, I'm a voracious reader, and I've been reading a really powerful book, and I want to share with you a quote from it that I think you're going to find really, really useful. Quick reminder, if you haven't grabbed a copy of my new book, Bridging the Gap, make sure you come across to the website or click one of the links in the email, because the book's going really well, and it's a quick read. You can read it on a plane, you can read it, you know, in an hour or two, and it's got some really powerful ideas. So make sure you grab yourself a copy of that later on. But what I want to do this week is, it's going to be a bit deeper. You know, often the weekly podcast is quite short, and I like to do that too because we're all so busy. But this week I want to go a little bit deep, and I really want to talk about human happiness. I want to talk about, you know, the X factor that we all want. You know, I think we assume that what we really want is money, that if we can just get enough money and deal with that, then everything's going to be fine. But as I've said on other podcasts, you know, there's been a lot of studies done on the relationship between money and human happiness. And what we do know is that if you're really poor and dealing with poverty and huge financial stress, then yes, money does make a difference and it alleviates unhappiness, but only up to a point. Once you have covered the basic needs, we find that adding more and more money to any individual human life doesn't increase the level of happiness. And you know that's true because if the relationship between money and happiness was absolutely direct, then obviously the happiest people in the world would be the richest people in the world. And that's obviously not the case. I mean, Bill Gates, or, you know, that guy in Mexico that owns the telco companies, or, you know, Richard Branson, all these different people who are incredibly wealthy, they're not necessarily the happiest people in the world. And if you've sort of looked at any of this research, you often find that sometimes people in the developed world have higher levels or report higher levels of happiness because their social networks are so strong. So one of the things we've done in Western culture is kind of, accelerate this reliance on ourselves and on accumulation, on possessions, and at the same time we've seen a growth in unhappiness. Now I want to balance that because, you know, I'm in business and I love business and I'm a big believer in what we can do with finance and wealth and creating great outcomes. But I'm also aware as I get older too that human happiness is really embedded in other things. So one of the points I want to make is that, look around you. What we know over the last, say, 50 years in the developed world, or in the, you know, the Western world, is that our material well-being has increased exponentially. So you mightn't feel that right now. You might be thinking, well, I'd like all this other stuff, and that's great for you, Jonathan, but I don't have X. But, you know, think on the big scale that we are sort of financially better off and materially better off than any time in human history. But at the same time as that's happened, our levels of depression and mental health have risen massively, or problems in those areas. You know, for a lot of years, antidepressant medication was the most widely prescribed medication in the Western world. I think now it's actually blood pressure medication. But, you know, look at those two things. You know, it tells us a little bit about where we are sort of culturally, when, you know, depression and heart disease are kind of the main sort of problems that we face epidemiologically, which is a great word, which just means in terms of health across the entire population. So let's dig a little bit here. Let's sort of ask ourselves, why is that? If we've got more stuff than ever, more distraction, more entertainment, why are we kind of less happy culturally than ever before? And I want to point you to a couple of things. You know, we've seen things like, you know, I'll talk about the growth in depression, but there really is a strong research or empirical basis to this. So there's a lot of studies done, interestingly, on narcissism, you know, self-absorption. The best of those studies was done by someone called Jean Tweng. I'm not sure if I'm getting that surname pronounced correctly. T-W-E-N-G-E. Jean Tweng did some very famous narcissism studies, or self-absorption studies, on sort of teenagers and people in their early 20s. And it has sort of risen massively from the previous generation to the current one. The levels of narcissism and self-absorption, I don't mean that critically. If you're hearing that, if you're a younger person, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying this is the cultural phenomena, that we've become a society that's much less focused on community and those around us, and really focused upon ourselves. Now, other writers have referred to this as what we call the imperious autonomous self. you know, this kind of grand sense of we are the focal point of the universe in ourselves and everything revolves around us. So we look at politics, religion, health, all these things, but we're viewing it all through the lens of our imperious autonomous self. Now, if that's the case, you know, is it possible that there's a link between self-absorption and unhappiness? Because we're really starting to accelerate at the moment into this culture of the self. Now, you know that's true again because you can look at stuff like, you know, look at a lot of social media. I mean, a huge amount of social media is just focused on the self. And when we, you know, we've got the famous term the selfie, where, you know, taking endless photographs of yourself and where you are and what you're doing, and that might be, well, I'm just, you know, I'm being in community with people, I'm sharing myself with people. But if you really look at the research, we know that that's not what's happening, that this culture of the self, the selfie, is really accelerating, and we just got to be aware of that and ask ourselves some questions about it. Definitely for younger people, and I've spent, you know, over a decade working very closely with the education sector, that the formation for a lot of our younger teenagers and younger children is that they, as their psyche develops, they're totally focused on their appearance and where they fit in their peer group and, you know, what they look like and what they own and what they possess. And even recently, the Dean of Harvard Business School, great quote from her book that I read recently, she said, you know, go online. She said, you know, consumption has become the identity cloak of a generation. Consumption has become the identity cloak of a generation. So we use social media to go, look what I bought, look what I'm using, look where I am, look at what I'm doing, look what I'm consuming. So we define ourselves by our consumption, what we drive, what we wear, all that sort of stuff. Now, I'm not in any way advocating some return to some mystical commune. I'm highlighting that what we're probably doing is descending into a sort of increasing self-absorption, and I don't think it's going to make us happy. In fact, I'm sure it's not, because the greatest minds in history have known that it's not. So if I'm in the ballpark correct that this self-absorption, this imperious autonomous self, is a big part of what's driving our unhappiness, then what is going to change that? So I mentioned earlier that I'm reading a book at the moment, and that book is a fascinating biography of the World War II hero from Australia, Edward Weary Dunlop. Now, I'd been hearing about Weary Dunlop most of my life. You know, I knew he was a famous figure from World War II. I knew he'd been imprisoned by the Japanese. I knew that he'd been in Asia, but I didn't know much about him other than, you know, he was a pretty amazing person and had done some incredible things. And so I don't know where I bought this book, but I've got this huge bookshelf where I just stockpile books that I'm buying and I just slowly try and work through them. And I thought, wow, I don't know why. Maybe it's just one of those, you know, God things where you just, you get the right book at the right time. So I've been reading through his story. And if you don't know anything about him, basically grew up in sort of rural Australia, you know, had a pretty, you know, not hard life, but by those standards of the day, you know, very independent life. He left the farm pretty early, was a brilliant student at Melbourne University, got into medicine, incredibly hardworking, and became a surgeon, and ended up in London, and then the war broke out. And he joined the army and he sort of was, you know, in Europe and then in the Mediterranean. And then, you know, they were getting sort of beaten by the Germans and then transferred to Java in Asia, and then they were captured. And the bulk of the book talks about his time in these prison camps. Now, very simply, if you're not familiar with this sequence of history, the treatment by the Imperial Japanese forces of the prisoners was utterly unspeakable. I mean, utterly horrendous, horrendous treatment. So to paint a quick picture, the sort of starvation, death, disease was unbelievable. You know, just the suffering and the filth and the starvation and all this amazing stuff. And so Weary Dunlop sort of he's a colonel by this stage, and, you know, he's in charge of all the healthcare, and just an incredible story of how he improvised and saved people's lives and his strength of character. But I was reading a bit last night, and there'd been a big cholera outbreak and people were dying everywhere. And so here he is himself. He had malaria. He had these chronic leg ulcers, these tropical septic leg ulcers, and the pain was unbelievable, you know, and he had dysentery. And so his level of suffering was extraordinary. And in the midst of all this, he's still leading and running the, you know, all the medical side of this camp. And the camps were called Konyu and Hintock. And I read a quote last night, and it's really fascinating because here's what happens is that the only kind of little pleasure that they had was smoking, and there was this strong local black tobacco, but they had no cigarette papers. So they eventually discovered that the pages of Bibles made really good smoking paper for cigarettes. And, you know, Weary talks about, you know, trying to memorize the best bits of the Bible that he wanted to remember because he realized that gradually the Bibles were disappearing. And he had no idea how long he was going to be in these camps. So he's memorizing bits of the Bible while he's tearing them up and smoking them. And it leads him to this kind of reflection on faith and God and Christianity. And he's sort of working through this. And he's definitely has a faith of sorts. But he's just obviously not quite sure how it all works amidst all this suffering. But then there's this sudden moment of revelation, and it's very, very powerful. And I'd like to read it to you from the book. And it says this, and some of it is an exact quote from his war diaries, from his actual journals. But it says, he was swept by the conviction that he was closer to the kingdom of heaven in Konyu and Hintock than at any other time. For him, the kingdom was at hand. Not a promise for the future, not dependent on life or death, but here, immediately, for those who could shed the awful shell of self and start loving their neighbour as thyself, possibly even more than self, to the point where death had no terror, only kindliness. So I hope you can listen to that again or read it on the transcript and maybe journal it or write it out, because you've got to picture him there. You've got to see him in this isolation cholera tent where people were dying all around him and he's so sick, but he keeps serving and serving and serving. And he has this kind of revelation that the presence of God, the real moment of being fully human was in the moment of radical service of others. So you probably know from listening to me for a while where I'm going with this, and like a lot of things in my book and a lot of things in my life, there's a great saying that the preacher always preaches first to themselves. This is the battle of my life too. This constant focus upon trying to be sensitive and aware of the needs of others. And I think it's the great journey for all of us that our happiness will come the more that we learn to focus less and less and less upon this imperious, autonomous self and focus more and more upon the needs of other people. Now, I want to give you some more quotes to flesh this out a little bit. There's an amazing book called The Seven Story Mountain, which was on the New York Times bestseller list in the 1950s, written by a famous monk called Thomas Merton. And I quote this quote in my book, and I do hope you grab a copy. But he makes this beautiful quote where he says, the meaning of life or the purpose of life is not self-actualization. And that was, you've probably heard of Abraham Maslow, and that was Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The highest human level was self-actualization, the full sort of awareness and realization of your possibilities. But Merton says, no, you're not right. He says that the ultimate meaning of life is not self-actualization, but self-transcendence. He said it is the ability, and this is Merton's words, to fully recollect yourself, which means to know who you are and what you're capable of. And then he says, so you can fully give. That the meaning of life is not self-actualization, but rather self-transcendence, in which you give yourself, you know, where you know who you are so you can fully give. And another great quote from Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who famously said, I have discovered, these are her words, I have discovered the great paradox, that if you love until it hurts, then there's no more hurt, only more love. Now, the last one is a quote from Albert Schweitzer, who, you know, another incredible person, an amazingly cultured man. He was a concert pianist in Europe. He had 3 PhDs by the time he died, one in medicine, surgery, music, and one other. And he ended up sort of leaving this amazing life as a famous concert pianist in England, in Europe, and founding a hospital for the poorest people in Africa. And late in his life, he was giving a famous university commencement address, and he finished it by saying, I don't know. He finished his last words where he said to this audience of young people, I don't know what each of you will go on to do, but I do know that those of you who will be happiest are those who have sought and found a way to serve. So you can take Weary Dunlop, you can take Thomas Merton, you can take Mother Teresa, you can take Albert Schweitzer, you can take the Bible or other, you know, great religious texts, but many of the great philosophers, men and women, theologians in history have all realized that the ultimate path to our happiness as human beings is through service of others. Can you at least take this away from the podcast? Can you step back and look at the cultural sort of what I call a disjunct? You know, look at the comparison between this radical, self-absorbed culture and, you know, this culture of radical self-service or radical service of others. So it's just such a stark contrast, isn't it? And if this seems abstract to you, like you've got to go and, you know, found an orphanage in Africa, no, it doesn't. See, I've got three young children, and I've been married now for, you know, for almost 15 years. And I am called to love and serve these guys and other people. And, you know, I'm traveling again now and speaking a lot more. And every time I get in front of an audience, the desire of my heart is to try and reach people with a message. And that's why I'm doing this morning. That's why I'm in the studio now trying to get this message out through a microphone. Do I live it perfectly? No, but I know that this is the path. So over to you now, if you're still listening to this, where is the place of your life where you're called to service of others? It's going to be in your home first. Often that's the hardest place, right? Because people drive you crazy and they know everything about you and they've seen you at your worst, and it can be so hard to step up and to love them and to care for them. But until we can do it there, there's not a lot of other places to do it. You know, that we've got to get it right there. And Mother Teresa was big on that too, that the place to start is in your home. The place to start is with your own family. You know, is someone lonely in your family? Is someone hurting in your family? In your workplace, who is the lonely person? Who's the person that's miserable? You know, we've got to break out of this imperious autonomous self. We've got to start going out to other people and meeting their needs. And I'm passionate about it. And I'm doing it in my little place, which right now is in a studio talking to you. But you're going to turn this off soon and your day is going to continue. And you've got to ask yourself that question. So I just want to leave you with that big idea. You know, if you can remember, hopefully in some way for the rest of your life, that happiness is not going to come in the next promotion. It's not going to come in the next car. It's not going to come in the next, you know, real estate investment or the next promotion or the next pay packet. Those things, we're allowed to enjoy them. They're part of the joy of life, you know, getting new stuff and having nice things around us. That's all fine. But the great big questions of life are always going to be there. You know, have you sought and found a way to serve? I really hope you'll grab a copy of the new book. These ideas are built out even more in there. You can just grab a copy and it'll be with you in a few days. I hope you can live this week. I really do. I hope you can just take some of this and just be reflective and how you can serve and meet the needs of others. So I'm Jonathan Doyle. This has been the Weekly Podcast, and I hope to have something fantastic for you again next week.